Hi, this is Andrew Heaton with The Reason Podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. I'm joined today by Nick Gillespie.
Thanks.
Matt Welch.
Hola.
And the indubitable Catherine Megu Ward.
Howdy.
So last week, the plot thickened with our president and James Comey, as James Comey went to Congress to talk about the various actions between him and Trump regarding the Russia investigation and Mike Flynn and all of that. Is this likely to actually crack open into a big thing, or is this just more drama? What do you think, Catherine?
It's always more drama. That's what we do here in Washington now. Obviously, everybody got really into the drama here in D.C. Bars were open at 10 a.m., promising shots for every Trump tweet. And the hearing itself, in many ways, I thought was a disappointment. Nothing particularly new was said. In the end, everyone felt that their own side was vindicated, and we returned to a general state of mild irritation and disarray.
Okay. Do you think there's actually going to be a break with Russia where something's going to happen that will actually have some juice to it? Nick?
No, let me put it this way, to kind of second what Catherine is saying. I think what we'll see is more drama, and this is the type of ongoing investigation that could really be, you know, kind of a side wound for Trump for the rest of his presidency. But I think the real takeaway, as far as I'm concerned, is the way in which the behavior kind of described by James Comey, and as well as the behavior by Donald Trump, it's both troubling, and it just furthers the idea, excuse me, that we really don't have authoritative institutions or people that we can trust. Trump is acting poorly. I think he's within the law of everything that he's doing. But he's a bad actor in general. He doesn't plan his actions out very well, and he's not presidential in that sense. But Comey, you know, what's going on where he's not actually saying anything in the moment to the people who are asking him to do what he later claims are bad things. It just strikes me, the FBI has a low reputation among most people who care about things like civil liberties or the Constitution or efficacy of law enforcement. And I don't think anything he's done is going to turn that around anytime soon.
Although he's weirdly become more popular through all of this.
Yeah, I was just about to
say.
Yeah,
well, of course,
Before he got fired, everybody hated him.
But that's
him.
Because everyone hates Trump. I mean, you know, what happens, like, and to be honest, this is one of the reasons I'm looking at data that, I've been looking at data that shows, you know, as bad as people dislike Trump, they also dislike Congress, they hate the media, et cetera. And what we're trapped in this thing where in any given face-off against somebody, it's like, oh, well, Trump is worse, so, you know, Comey wins. But in fact, what happens is I think we're just corroding and eroding all of the bases of legitimate authority in America. And that, you know, on a certain level, that's good. And on another level, it's very, very bad for social kind of cohesion.
I also think any scenario in which the FBI director is coming across as the good guy is a moment that America should pause and worry. I mean, we have a long, proud tradition of being deeply skeptical of our directors of the FBI. That's because it's a powerful position that is by its very nature, somewhat unsupervised or unaccountable to the people. And the idea that there was at least a minority contingent, if not a majority, who walked away from that hearing saying, you know, wow, James Comey is the hero we need in 2017. You know, that's not our best case scenario for our democracy. He made it very clear that on multiple occasions when Trump asked him something he was uncomfortable with, he essentially equivocated or dodged or tried to work around
he wrote a strongly worded secret memo that strongly he then leaked to a
right.
friend who read it to the New York Times. I mean, this is like, what the hell, you know?
Yeah, not all heroes wear capes, but this guy's pretty far from.
That's one of the interesting things, I think, about the Trump administration is that in preceding administrations, people would say things like, you know, I disagree with the president, but I respect his office. And that is precipitously declining, that institutional support. Which I'm generally in favor of, although I don't know how much I like it eroding between the FBI and the presidency. Matt, are you getting the popcorn ready for Jeff Sessions this week?
Hopefully it will be in a public setting, not because it's going to improve the testimony or the amount of camera hogging we'll see from Chuck Schumer. But because I think as much as we can, this should be public. It should be a long, drawn-out public humiliation of the executive branch with clowning from the legislative and kibitzing from the media. That's kind of how the process works, which is something that people have a hard time remembering. This was true back in the Watergate days, too. Like, you know, those who say, well, the upside of Trump is that it's going to make people skeptical of an authoritarian executive branch, and it's going to make the Jack Goldsmiths of the world, who was, as a lawyer, was a very defensive of George W. Bush's expansions of his executive power. He's now coming out and saying, well, you know what? You know, for the first time, I'm really starting to worry about this. But I think people, when they come around to that, they're nonetheless put off by the theatrics of how these things look, but that's just the system. The system is designed to be theatrical, so we're going to see a lot of poor behavior there. But I think it's worth the pausing and thinking about on that for a second, and building up what both Catherine and Nick were saying. There's a guy who's kind of a must follow in the Trump period named Benjamin Wittes, who's associated at the Brookings Institution. He's got a blog called the Lawfare blog. And he took a small role in the Comey drama because he's one of the friends of Comey. And so, you know, he's famous for doing tick, tick, tick tweets on days when he knows some big news is going to be broken. He had an interesting series of tweets over the weekend in which he said, hey, you know, shout out to my civil libertarian, my new liberal readers out there. You're going to be disappointed in me sooner rather than later, because I am essentially, and this is his words, an apologist for the national security state. And I think it's interesting that a lot of the people who were most alarmed by Trump's behaviors, his deviations from norms, the way that he's a challenge to institutions, are precisely those who have done the most to defend, to even expand the powers of those very institutions, which have done a lot of wickedness in this world, who have abused their power, who have given Trump the power that he is abusing even now. So even as we go through what I think is ultimately a healthy process, especially in the Mueller investigation, which is going to last years and probably be a perennial source of drama and headlines out there. It is kind of at heart queasy making that some of the strongest drivers of this are people who gave these institutions, which have failed us time and time again, a lot of the power and whatever kind of credibility that they have.
Something that I'm continually baffled by is that the left and right, when they're out of power, are wonderful proponents of limited government. And then when they're in power, when President Obama was in office, the attitude from the left was generally, well, you know, we have a Marcus Aurelius character that can be trusted with this incredible power, and it will always be thus. And, you know, now it's the shoe's on the other foot, and we're seeing that come around and bite everybody. Before I forget, I'm curious.
Wait, Andrew, I'm sorry. Can I interrupt and ask what kind of shoes bite?
Did I say shoe?
Think you said the shoe is on the other foot and it's coming around to bite us now.
Strangely, made a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, something in the New York water about the metaphor mixing.
You know, I can't explain all fashion to you, but a lot of shoes bite, you know, it's what Crocs do. Nick, do you know what McCain was asking during the testimony with Comey? Because I tried to piece that together, and I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, I don't have any idea, to be quite honest. If Catherine or Matt does, they should speak now, because I
do, actually. So, and Jacob Sullum, who's writing in general, is always worth your time, but he had a piece on this on Friday, I believe. McCain was kind of poking around at the difference between criminality and impropriety, and he was using as the comparative standard, as Jacob has previously, the James Comey's, of all people, decision not to prosecute Hillary Clinton, although over the email scandal, even though her behavior would seem to violate the letter of the law. His argument, James Comey's argument at that time, was you need criminal intent, you need mens rea, which is something that I wish all defendants would get the benefit of the doubt of, and not just powerful people. But there's a point there. And so I think McCain was trying to say, comparing the two, are you applying a consistent standard? And that is an important thing when we try to assess whether Trump's behavior has risen to the level of obstruction of justice. He would have to know that he's acting in such a way that he did. So we're giving McCain the benefit of the doubt that that's what he was trying to do, but that seems to be what he was poking towards.
One of the people that was particularly intense on Comey was Rubio, who had not been particularly good friends with Trump during the election, but seems to have been co-opted or swung over to him. Is Trump been able to kind of reassemble a Republican coalition to back him? And can we see more of that moving forward? Catherine, what do you think?
I think that if your coalition that you've assembled moving forward is Rubio, with your on point, it's not much of a coalition. And I think these hearings always bring out the sort of weird grandstanding in a way that doesn't always mesh with actual political agendas. I'm not convinced that, just because Rubio decided this was the best way to get the camera on him for the Comey hearing on Thursday, that this is a sign of things to come necessarily. I mean, on the flip side, we had, Kamala Harris, who is being talked about as a rising star, showing up again because, hey, look, cameras, better get going, better get some attention on me. And as someone said earlier, of course, Chuck Schumer is the master of this, and we can expect to see him doing that coming up soon here with Sessions. I don't know. I guess I wouldn't overread the sort of childish elbow throwing that happens whenever there's a high profile hearing.
If I can speak up in defense of who Donald Trump referred to as Little Marco during the campaign season, I think Rubio asked a question which kind of goes to what Matt was talking about with regard to McCain, which was he asked Comey point blank, did Donald Trump ever ask you to do anything improper or illegal? And Comey answered no. And to my mind, that's important because these hearings, and again, Andrew, to go to your point about how people are fair weather constitutionalists and things like that, there's a sense, and this started, I suppose, with the Clinton administration, but that the best thing that you can do to kind of do a slow bleed on your enemies is to put them under constant scrutiny for behavior that might be, it might be improper, it might be dubious, it might be stupid, but it's not illegal. And I think that's what, we're in the process of doing that now in a lot of ways, where it's, people hate Trump, people dislike him. And so you start to do stuff, and everything he does is not just dumb and stupid, but illegal and immoral and worthy of an impeachment. Can we start impeaching already? I mean, people have been talking about that. And I think Rubio, assuming that he's doing that out of principle and not just out of partisanship, I think that's a good thing to, that's a good distinction to keep in mind, because part of the problem with contemporary politics is that we can't disagree without everything being thrown into question. And, and the scales of justice are like, swinging wildly from one extreme to the other, rather than just being, talking about disagreements and getting on with how to move forward.
I also think there's an element here in Comey's testimony where he essentially said over and over under repeated questioning, listen, it just felt yucky. The conversation felt bad. It felt like my interpretation of what he was asking me, which admittedly was not in his plain text. And I think one reason that we're litigating this on the level of inappropriate versus illegal is because Trump is actually quite skilled at walking that line. People are acting like, oh, he didn't know they weren't allowed to have this conversation. But it sounds to me like in this conversation, he managed to stay south of the illegal line. And, you don't do that accidentally. He knew because he managed to do that because he knew it was there. And my belief, and based on accounts of his career as a businessman, is that Trump frequently walks that line. And so it is both highly relevant for a highly placed person with good judgment to say the conversation felt like he was trying to shove me in the direction of bad behavior without actually formally requesting it. And also, it does make Rubio and McCain's questions on point, but I don't think that's why they asked them in that forum. They asked them in that forum because there were cameras and they wanted to do whatever they felt was right to promote their own brand at that moment.
That's one of the things which
I was going to say, if I can just follow up on that, I think part of what we're seeing here too, and this is independent of Trump's personality or Comey's, but there's a real clash of cultures between political culture and business culture. And neither necessarily is right or better or more ethical, but, you know, there may be fewer, or rather the procedures and processes that are in place to restrain and self-regulate business conversations, I think, are probably very different than the procedures and processes that are in place for political discussions. And part of it is that Trump obviously is a political neophyte. He has no experience, and he shows very little regard or interest in learning, you know, the kind of etiquette of politics. And I think that's at play here, too.
I'll add to your comment, Catherine, about the grandstanding that goes on, that I think that's an endemic element to congressional testimonies. When I worked on the Hill, and I was just there briefly and in a very, very low capacity, some of my friends would talk about how they would watch someone get torn to shreds by a congressman. And then once the cameras were off, the congressman would come up and say, "Hey, I'm really sorry about that. I've been kind of down in the polls. I needed to get, you know, some good sound bites out of this." I didn't witness that, but it's not uncommon to have that there. And you can see the you know, intense amount of media hogging that comes out of those things. I would prefer that they just do written transcripts for everybody. That way it wouldn't be as influenced. But I think it'll probably be an ongoing fixture of the Trump administration. And across the pond, there's probably going to be a new administration. The United Kingdom has had an election recently. They were choosing between the two large options of accidental Prime Minister Theresa May and unreformed Marxist goblin Jeremy Corbyn. And they decided on neither. The government is now a minority government, or will be a minority government, in the United Kingdom. They're still figuring out how that's going to be cobbled together, but it seems it's going to involve a small party out of Ireland called the Democratic Unionists Party, which is kind of their social conservative wing. And that's now going to team up with the conservatives to keep the coalition or to keep May in power. Is there anything good that came out of that, Matt?
Oh, God. Brett Stevens over at the New York Times, late of the Wall Street Journal, kind of a neoconservative anti-Trumper guy, had a column today that I think has an interesting frame on it called "The Year of Voting Recklessly," where in our election in 2016, arguably in the Brexit votes, in a lot of the different votes out there, you see voters saying, "Screw it. All you people who tell us that we can't do this because it's just a bridge too far," are rejecting that as a possibility. And so I'm getting in the head here of the Corbyn voters, especially because he was a guy who was universally loathed by all of the British media and has been for a long time. And I would hasten to add for very good reason. And like, you just can't go back to this 1970s era liberalism, pre-Tony Blair labor type of politics and cozying up with lousy third world Marxists like Hugo Chavez, and especially in the wake of Brexit, which was another moment where people rejected what the advice of their betters. I think people are rolling the dice, and it speaks to the knitting it together with what Nick was talking about, low trust the moments. It's the people who were telling everybody what they can and can't do. They have squandered the trust of people who vote in elections. And so we're in this kind of perilous, weird, interesting time here across the Western world. And it doesn't map out neatly. I mean, we're seeing kind of an opposite thing happening in France right now, where Emmanuel Macron is about ready to have the biggest parliamentary majority since Charles de Gaulle, even though he didn't have a political party until a year ago. And he's kind of making it up as he goes along. And that can be seen as a rejection of France's flirtation with the National Front, a sort of a Trump, a proto-Trump style party. So it doesn't map out perfectly evenly, for sure. But you have voters definitely willing to say, "Okay, tell us what we can't do, because we might vote for that."
So sort of a reflexive, not even necessarily populist, but just sort of anti-establishment sentiment that is kicking into high gear globally?
I think so.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I don't know.
But by the same token, you know, I think it's I would hesitate to link it up to a national sentiment or a global sentiment, particularly against globalization or integration, because Macron is, Matt was pointing out, it's pretty fascinating that this is a guy with a, you know, with a fake party, essentially, and he's looking really strong. I think what you're seeing is more in each of these cases, including to a certain degree Trump, it's a rejection of different democracies, a rejection of the status quo or the stuff that is, you know, the political dynasties or the political status quo. So that takes a different form in England or in Britain than it does in France, than it does in the United States. I'm energized by it, not because I think it's going to work out well in all or any of these cases, but I think it shows, you know, we are in, this is my drum that I'm trying to beat as much as I can. We're in the last years of the long 20th century, and people are tired of the same old stuff. Matt has a piece up at Reason that's great about, you know, Chelsea Clinton and the end of the Clinton dynasty. I mean, you know, in a lot of ways, this election, the 2016 election in the U.S. was originally posited as, you know, as the final showdown, the thriller in Manila of the Bush and Clinton dynasties. And it didn't work out that way, not because we love Trump, but because we want anything else than what we've had for the past 30 years. And I think there's a lot of that going around.
Catherine, so classical liberalism gets started in the United Kingdom and seems to be on the descent. From a libertarian perspective, are you excited about all these developments? Do you see it as something dynamic? Do you see it as veering away from individual rights?
You know, I'm generally a pretty cheerful, optimistic type person, but I actually disagree with Nick that this is an energizing phenomenon. I think it's just chaos. I think I have no faith at all that when various populations, including the population in the UK, get generically fed up with business as usual, that we have no indication that they're going to move in a classical liberal small government or libertarian direction, and lots of indications that they aren't. And I think that's what we saw with Trump, that, you know, that's here in the United States, people said, we're totally right to say the status quo is garbage, fuck this noise. But their response, as in, you know, this, there, you can map this onto private interactions. Sometimes when you get fed up and you decide to make a change, you make it hastily and not for the better. And I fear that that is the broader trend. I don't think there's a clear way out here, right? I mean, it's not as if I could say, like, yes, but if everyone just calmed down and continued the status quo, we would then, you know, proceed with our gentle march toward liberty. That's not what's happening either. But I certainly don't see that between the lines of what's happening, you know, in France or in the UK.
To clarify a little bit, I'm not saying that any of these actions that are happening or that have happened in, you know, whether it's the Brexit vote and the collapse of May, Macron winning or Trump, that any of them are, you know, leading to a libertarian moment. I think that they open the space for that. And I do think with Trump in America, it's kind of fascinating that somebody like Hillary Clinton, who is in one of the major parties, is as an establishment a candidate as you could, who had all the backing of all of the people in her party in terms of the establishment. It was a foregone conclusion. The fact that she couldn't pull 50% of the vote, of the popular vote, is pretty stunning. And I think it's a rejection of something. And it's a politics of exhaustion where, like, these people, the establishment in our political class, can't force us to do their bidding anymore. That doesn't mean Trump is good, but it also doesn't mean that Trump is all bad. And he's already, in a bunch of ways, is pushing on policies that I think are very consistent or congruent, or at least work within a move towards a more libertarian world in terms of regulations. I think of stuff that, generally speaking, the EPA, the FDA, the FCC, school choice, those are all good. He's no libertarian, that's for sure. But it opens up the possibility, because Trump is not going to be a two-termer. Trump is not the beginning of something new. He is the last gasp of a kind of blend that's not all that different in many ways from what Hillary Clinton was offering. So I'm merely saying what we're witnessing is the end of a bunch of things. And in that end, there is the possibility that if, you know, and this is something that I think at Reason and other places we need to do. We need to sketch out what that vision of a different 21st century ordered world where politics, you know, and Matt and I obviously in the Declaration of Independence wrote a lot about this, but where political policy or policy and politics follows all of the kind of individualization, the personalization, the freedom and autonomy that we're gaining in our commercial lives, in our economic lives, and in our personal lives.
I love to hear you sing that song about the libertarian moment, man. I do. But I think the extent to which libertarian policies are happening under Trump or might happen in a post-Brexit Europe, say, I think it is almost entirely incidental to the impulses behind those changes. And the impulse behind those changes is just a very, so far within the standard operating procedure of our institutions, a sort of let's burn it to the ground and see what comes up next. And I lack faith that the general populace in their political actions will move us in the direction of freedom. Luckily, I think the world outside of politics gets bigger and better, and you and I can sing that tune together.
One thing to add about Brexit is that this can be seen to some degree, at least, as the people waking up post Brexit, which is, hey, look, we got our sovereignty back. We did this thing that people told us that we couldn't do. And it turns out the way that Brexit was portrayed by the pro-leave side has very little in common to do with the negotiations that are happening very badly right now with leaving the European Union. So there is you can start building up fantasies based on stuff that you can never get. And you can make a very potent politics based on that. Well, if only we did this, then all of these good things will happen. Well, at some point you get in power and those things are exposed as being fantasies. And so we're seeing right now Britain's going to leave the EU probably on much worse terms than they ever thought, the people who were voting for it. And so there's a bit of a reckoning with reality. And it'll be interesting to see that happen in this country or any country where people whose ideas that stoked some of these electoral victories see what it's like when their candidate or their team holds power to enact those ideas and sees what they look like when they get in contact to reality.
To go back to kind of the dichotomy that Catherine and Nick were espousing between this sort of gradual reform versus burn the house down. I read a book a couple of years ago on Burke and Payne, and the sort of Burkean philosophy is that reform and revolution are opposites, whereas Payne's philosophy was pretty much just if the house has termites, burn it to the ground. Nick, I'd gather you're more in the Payne camp. You like sort of violent chaos and stuff coming out of that as opposed to gradual reform?
That's a hell of a question, Heaton. You're like, so Nick, what you're saying is you like violence and chaos?
Yeah, I'm having trouble unzipping my bondage mask, so I might sound a little muffled right now. Yeah, I like pain. I like pain. Give me the pain, that sweet, sweet pain. I actually think both Burke and Payne are, you know, they're extremes on a certain level, and it's not the case. And when you look at U.S. history, or certainly just keeping it to, you know, the post-World War II era, you know, none of this stuff happened. All of the many major changes in both kind of civil society as well as politics happened, you know, pretty much without upsetting the apple cart and stuff like that. There was violence. There was violence against civil rights marchers. There were violent protests at the 1968 Democratic National Convention, all of that kind of stuff. But in general, it's all reform. In a system as loose as the United States, a lot of this stuff happens, through reform. So I kind of reject that dichotomy to begin with. But I think what is happening, or, you know, we are in this weird space where the institutions and the laws and the frameworks that we've evolved over the past 50, 60, 70 years to deal with life in America are very firmly entrenched. So when you talk about old age entitlements, when you talk about military industrial spending, which really only dates back to World War II and the decade after World War II, these things are very firmly in place, but they no longer really address where we are or where we're going as a society. And that's where the tension is. And I think, again, we've run out of options. Trump has no really good large-scale policies. He's talking about keeping immigrants out. He's talking about, closing borders or raising tariffs and things like that. That's not going to work. And that's not that different than what's been tried, you know, for 200 years here. So we need something different. And I think out of the exhaustion, when you have a president who wins 43 or 44% of the popular vote, people are kind of indicating that, yeah, we have to elect somebody by definition, but we're not, you know, nobody's happy with where we are right now.
And I think another thing that came out of the 2016 election was just the realization that very few people in America are actually that ideological. Everyone on the podcast presumably has a fairly well thought out political compass that we use in terms of determining who we like and what policies we like. I don't think that's true for a lot of the people in the country that are acting partly on emotion and kind of have a loose confederation of things that are important to them. And we're seeing that manifested in Trump, who, as you point out, Nick, is not a libertarian. And another person who's definitely not a libertarian, or might be, but we'll get into it now, is Alex Jones, who is going to be on an interview with Megyn Kelly, I think next Sunday, but the preview of it's out. And Alex Jones is alternately described as far right, extreme right, conspiracy theorist, libertarian. How do you guys feel about him being described as a libertarian? Is that an accurate portrayal of him? Matt, are you okay with him being a luminary in our camp?
He's not a libertarian. He's a performance artist, conspiracy theorist, media weirdo. So a year ago or so, I went to cover the Libertarian Party a national convention, which is a tumultuous and interesting time. And I was and it was also right next to like a big Comic-Con style thing. So there's a bunch of people in Batman costumes and furries and things. So it was great. And I needed to take a little break in the Sky Bridge to go do some writing or something. And I went and I thought, OK, I'm alone. I finally, you know, got some peace here. And then a guy sits down next to me. And he's got some signs, and I don't want to look at the signs. I'm just like trying to get in my own thing, going to write. And then his phone rings, and he starts talking. And he talks with just really some of the most bitter disappointment that these people at the Libertarian convention are so closed-minded about the truth. And I get to start craning my head over at his signs. And of course, he's a Sandy Hook truther, somebody who believes that the Sandy Hook massacre was not perpetrated by the guy who did it. But I don't even know and don't want to know what the going theory is about this. But Alex Jones has trafficked in that for a long time. It's one of the worst of the many bad things that he has done. But I found it very interesting that this guy thought that he would have fertile ground among the libertarians to come up with absolutely conspiratorial wacko nut job stuff, and it didn't work. And yet the guy, the media avatar, who's most famous for peddling that, now is someone who the president's most loyal supporters really like and find very interesting in the Republican Party. So hats off to libertarians for not falling for Sandy Hook crap. Generally speaking, I welcome the fact that people of all stripes want to describe themselves as libertarian. Noam Chomsky is a libertarian socialist, I think is what he calls himself. You know, Bill Maher used to use the phrase. All kinds of people who are not libertarians use the phrase. I don't get worried about it at all. It's our job to, when asked, give our own senses of what we think libertarianism might be. I don't like to play a policeman of that term at all, and to point out in the many ways in which Alex Jones and other people are not. But I can't get worried about what freak jobs outside of my control describe themselves as.
Nick, are you ever putting out any fires that Alex Jones lights?
I felt that that last comment by Matt was directed at me, and I apologize. I'm one of the freak jobs out there. Now, Alex Jones is not a libertarian. I think he's closer to what Matt was getting at when he called him a performance artist. There's something deeply troubling about a Sandy Hook truther. He believes that the government used actors, or at least he did at a certain time in the clip for the Megyn Kelly preview. He repeats the idea that 9/11, I mean, literally the statement that 9/11 was an inside job. These are stupid and ultimately contemptible points of view, I think. And he's as bad as anybody in Congress or the Senate in terms of getting camera time. Trump legitimated Alex Jones in a way that should be deeply worrying to people with any modicum of gray matter left. Trump appeared on InfoWars and things like that. I don't think Alex Jones is a libertarian. I will say this, that I think it's kind of a good sign that even when nut jobs like Alex Jones are trying to be libertarian, it's a sign if you've been in, you know, I've been in Reason since 1993. More people are talking about being libertarian. More people use it as part of a modifier. You know, Matt mentioned Noam Chomsky and Bill Maher. Bill Buckley, towards the end of his life, wrote a collection where he claimed to be, this was like the memoir of a libertarian journalist. This kind of stuff is happening, and it's happening for a reason, which is that the core value of libertarianism, which is individual freedom and innovation and flourishing and tolerance, you know, limited government, yeah, but even more to the point, tolerance and mutual respect for different ways of living and experiments in living. I think, you know, it's on the grow because, again, it's the way out of this long 20th century where you have a right wing and a left wing that is very much into kind of controlling things and shutting down choices. You know, the right and the left want to shut down different choices that people have to live their lives the way they want to, or to run their businesses, or to constitute their families. But they want to control things, and that's what libertarianism actually stands against.
Catherine, can Alex Jones simultaneously be a nut job and a libertarian? Can these be overlapping Venn diagrams, or is he flat out not ideologically libertarian?
Of course, all ideologies house nut jobs within them. There is nothing, unfortunately, there is nothing internally contradictory about being an absolutely batshit crazy person who is also a ideologically consistent libertarian with policies I would fully agree with. Alex Jones is not an ideologically consistent libertarian who holds policies or espouses policies I would agree with. He definitely is, in fact, a nut job. I think Nick and Matt are right that we are not the Bill Buckleys of libertarianism. We are not in the business of saying who's in and who's out of the movement. The appeal of that word, I think, is people's response to seeing authoritarianism all around them. I mean, when you get those dumb internet quizzes that have to put something on the other end of the axis from authoritarian, it's typically the word libertarian or on the other end of the axis from statist. And I like anything where the underlying impulse is like, whoa, Jesus Christ, maybe these guys who want to boss us around have gotten a little out of hand. I don't think that has any darn thing to do with the theory that Sandy Hook was staged, which it freaking wasn't. I see him absolutely in the lineup that goes Bill Maher, Glenn Beck, Alex Jones, people who are saying the word libertarian at a moment in their career when they're like a little bit unmoored and maybe hoping that some club will let them in. Surprise, we don't even have a clubhouse. So too bad, suckers.
We only have cash bars, right?
That's right.
No open bar.
That's right.
You know what? The other thing about Alex Jones, though, which is kind of interesting, is the whole independent media or new media angle of him. There's something kind of amazing that somebody like Megyn Kelly, who was on the Fox News Channel, which, you know, 20 years ago was new media. Now it's the establishment. But she bounces over to NBC and she's interviewing a guy who, you know, is doing a YouTube show, and in that, I mean, this says nothing specific about any of the people involved, but it's kind of glorious that the media landscape has changed, where Donald Trump was going out of his way to kiss the ass of somebody like Alex Jones. This is a different world. It's a different landscape. And it leaves open a lot of possibilities for people to get into conversations and have their point of view heard and build an audience and kind of a movement. So in that sense, Alex Jones has something to teach us all.
Matt, do you think that Jones is adding to political discourse or just kind of bringing in a wingnut element? I mean, I'm intrigued because I like having fringe thinkers because a lot of interesting ideas tend to come out of the fringe rather than the middle. But I personally don't think he's really doing much to elevate discourse. But I'm curious of your thoughts, Matt.
I don't wake up in the morning worrying about who's elevating discourse or not, and I don't choose to watch Alex Jones ever, unless Michael Moynihan's doing an impersonation of him or something like that, or an interview with him, which was actually pretty good for Vice News. So that's a strange test to apply. I agree, Andrew, that there is the exercise of having open fringes is interesting, and I'm always wrestling back and forth with how much does one pay attention to it, because usually the fringe doesn't hold power and doesn't affect power that much. There's this interesting meta conversation right now happening on Twitter. Megyn Kelly's getting a lot of heat for doing this interview, which is bizarre because Alex Jones has been the subject of many, many, many interviews, including the aforementioned one at Vice, that were not subject to the same kind of scrutiny as Megyn is getting. It's like she's legitimating his point of view, and it's terrible what she's doing with the families of Sandy Hook and all these kinds of things. I think that, yes, you should always focus your lights on power and not be so obsessed with the lunatic fringe. But occasionally that lunatic fringe ends up, informing or being part of the culture that comes to power. And so in this case, Alex Jones is a very, very worthwhile figure to try to figure out and an audience to try to figure out, because I think there's a pretty strong overlap with some elements of Trumpism underneath it, which is not to say that Trump should be tarred with all the beliefs that Alex Jones has. It's not that. But there's a culture behind him, and that culture adhered very strongly to Trump. So it is interesting to figure that out more than just, stand like a referee, throw a flag and say this is impermissible to even engage with intellectually. It's better to understand the world around you. And perhaps sadly, that world does include this guy.
And I think anybody who ever clicked on an article after the election that was like, this is why Trump won, you can't be that guy and say we don't want to hear from Alex Jones. This is the people like Alex Jones are one reason, not all the reasons, but one reason that Trump won. So if you genuinely are in the project of trying to understand what's going on in American politics, it's a totally appropriate thing to do to say, like, okay, well, let's muck around down here at the bottom and see what people think.
Well, and based on the preview, it didn't look like Megyn Kelly was giving him blowball questions or softball questions. She calls him out that he's dodging on Sandy Hook and redirects him to it. So I don't get the impression that she was, glorifying his position or anything like that. Catherine, do you have a read on how much of Alex Jones really believes Alex Jones versus how much of it's just entertainment?
I have no read at all, since I have probably only consumed, I don't know, a total of an hour of Alex Jones in my entire life. I think that there is, of course, an element of performance in this. I think Penn Jillette, who I interviewed and asked about this phenomenon generally a while back, makes a good point, which is that all of these people are some form of entertainment, all the way from the New York Times editorial page to, the Real Housewives of whatever county they're in now. And you just have to understand what the standards are within each subgenre. And I think his standards are very obviously lower than those of the New York Times. But, I think one reason the Megyn Kelly interview makes people nervous is because of what Matt said, that, she was new media, now she's old media-ish. He's the slightly newer new media, and people are not quite sure where their standards of truth reside and if they are moving and in which direction. And that's the trouble. It's not, are you an entertainer or are you a truth teller? It's just, what should your audience expect?
Nick, are there any conspiracy theories you wish were getting more scrutiny?
Negative or positive?
Negative or positive, you mean like, is in...
I want to know if you're asking Nick which conspiracy theories he believes in or which ones need to be debunked. Because I'm interested in both of those answers.
I am, sadly, I am such a burnt out husk of a human being that I don't even believe in conspiracy theories anymore. because if they were true, we would know that.
You don't even believe in Jesse Walker anymore?
Yeah, well, I haven't seen him in I don't know, it seems like, 20 or 30 years at this point. So it's... Jesse Walker, our recent colleague's book on conspiracy theory and kind of the thinking and the way it plays out in American politics is great for sure. And I actually am kind of in that space where You know, it's easier now than ever to kind of generate conspiracy theories, and sometimes they take, sometimes they don't, sometimes they're kind of true. I've always enjoyed conspiracy theories because they have a gesture that is very common to, you know, kind of the modern period of like where you figure out who are the main actors and what are the main rules and how do things happen and how did we get here? And it's just they go off the rails. But I used to be a big fan of conspiracy theories, particularly about the Kennedy assassination and about like the Manson family and all of this kind of stuff. But sadly, I don't really believe in any conspiracy theories anymore, other than that myself and the Javier Bardem character in No Country for Old Men go to the same barber, which I think is generally true.
Following the election, there was a lot of scrutiny on fake news and a lot of talk about fake news altering the outcome of the election. Matt, do you think that is a fair assessment, that the sheer volume of fictional stories coming out are influencing directly the political structure we're in now?
No. I mean, it colors things. We tend to try to complicate things. People went to the voting booths, and as far as we knew, those votes were counted correctly and added up correctly, and they have any number of motivations and thoughts that go into it. And some people believe crap from the left and some people believe crap from the right. It's not necessarily equal. It's just everyone believes in some amount of crap. I mean, go to a march for science and you will find a bunch of people who believe in completely unscientific crap. I don't get overly exercised about fake news. It might be interesting that there's more of like an industry, a self-conscious industry of people who are trying to engineer these stories and feed them and plant them. And the technology part of it is what kind of makes it new, because these things have been with us for a really long time, certainly very heavily in the Cold War, in terms of all kinds of publications that everyone thought was pristine and sui generis ended up being financed by the CIA or even KGB and this kind of stuff. So we've seen fake news for the entirety of the American Republic and certainly before it. It's just that it's like, you know, in the 90s, if you put cyber in front of anything, people would freak out, or hacker in front of something. Then, my God, this is a new thing. E with a hyphen. Oh, my God. It's E news. I don't get too excited about it. I think we have agency of our own selves, and it's just part of the landscape and not a particularly overly important one, I don't think.
People are getting excited here in New York about something that might be blown out of proportion, which is Delta and the Bank of America withdrawing their financial support from the Public Theater here in New York. So this theater is an ongoing, they do Shakespeare productions, and this year the Shakespeare production features a man that very much appears to be Donald Trump in the role of Julius Caesar. So it's Caesar. Don't spoil it for me because I haven't seen it yet, but Caesar is this, you know, nascent dictator, and in their telling of it, he has blonde hair and a suit and a Slavic wife. So there seem to be some parallels. And because he, in fact, does get killed at one point, there's been concern that this is, you know, going beyond the confines of good taste. Catherine, do you think they went over the line?
No. And I think that more than anything, the fact that there's been a kerfuffle about corporate sponsorship of this production just shows that it's this sort of deeply weird thing that corporations sponsor arts with political content, right? Sure, by all means, put on your production of Julius Caesar, where Trump is Julius Caesar. This is, this is what theater people do. This is how we do political commentary. Yes, yes, yes. All of this is clearly protected speech, because I assume that tomorrow's second wave of this, if we're going to have it, is, oh, well, maybe this is really a threat against the president. It's not. It's a play in which Trump is being cast as Julius Caesar. But I was struck by the fact that, you know, I was at D.C.'s Pride Parade this weekend, and, you know, half the people in the crowd were like grumbling about how corporate pride has become. And I was like, this is warming my little heart. The idea that, you know, Hilton and Marriott are competing for who has the better float in the Pride Parade. And likewise, you know, you could say, OK, well, yeah. And also Delta should feel free to sponsor, you know, political productions of plays. But at that point, it's just marketing. And it's, in this case, marketing gone wrong. It's not something their brand wants to be associated with. This play did not have the right to be sponsored by Delta, but they certainly have the right to put on the play.
Why are we in the 21st century, why are we putting, and in Trump's America, putting on plays by foreigners?
Good point.
Isn't there an American playwright that we could be producing? Whatever happened to Neil Simon, you know, Barefoot in the Park, or how about a musical, you know, where boy meets girl, boy marries girl, they live happily ever after?
Here's the reason why you should have Shakespeare in the Park, Nick Gillespie, is that the lead in my neighborhood, Shakespeare in the Park, Richard III, which they chose totally because of Trump, and he dresses in a red tie and the whole bit. The lead in that play is a subscriber to Reason Magazine. And he read the Declaration of Independence and is a big fan. So let's support out there Carroll Park, Smith Street Stage.
I hate Shakespeare. I hate Shakespeare. So it's over for Shakespeare. Come on.
That sounded on. You 100%. Your Trump impression there was terrifying.
I was not trying to sound like Trump.
I know, but you sure
did. Have to try. It's all out of Burroughs.
I think Shakespeare is the type of bauble that Trump would use. It's like gold plating. Oh, I'm a very cultured person. I like Shakespeare. You know, come on. But in any case, yeah, corporations should be able to sponsor what they want and pull away when they don't want to. I do think there's, and people will remember this from the Bush years, there was a flurry of like fake documentaries or mockumentaries like The Killing of a President, where it was a documentary detailing a fictional assassination of George W. Bush. Bush's head showed up on pikes in the background of
Game of Thrones
yeah. scenes and things like that. These are all cheap theatrics, to be honest. Julius Caesar is actually a really good play, and it's a really good play about reform versus revolution and assassination. And it's always worth reading from that perspective, regardless of of what modern day garb the actors are injecting in a desperate attempt to make Shakespeare still plausible in the 21st century.
The part that's dreary for me is to watch the predictable sorts say, see, what we're just doing is we're giving the left a taste of its own medicine. Remember that, there was a rodeo clown under Obama who like lost his job over this. And it's like, please point out the hypocrisy, but don't become the asshole. You're becoming the asshole. It's not like cute. You're just becoming the asshole. You're actually getting mad about a Julius Caesar production in the park. When, you know, there was a piece in 2012 of Julius Caesar, who's played by Obama or an Obama-like character, and everyone was fine with it. So just like stop being the asshole.
But, you know, it's also to go towards that, the kind of cheapness that these flourishes get made. So what's the reading? And I haven't read reviews of the play, but if Trump is Julius Caesar, the protagonist in Julius Caesar is Brutus, his son. And the conspirators are not good people. I mean, no matter how bad Caesar is, the conspirators are not good people. So I'm curious, who is there, a Democratic Party person or a Republican? Is it Marco Rubio, who's Brutus and who leads a conspiracy and then is riven by guilt and also recognizing the failure of the action? Because this also ends with, Mark Antony, and it leads to new and in many ways a worse kind of set of dictators and tyrants running the Roman Republic or Empire. So, think it through also, because there are times where you can use historical fiction or plays or history to illuminate the current moment, but it rarely works out as easily as this glib, tossing Trump in as Julius Caesar seems to have any real coherence to it.
I mean, I think it's a cautionary tale, Nick, against the metaphorical assassination of impeachment. They're warning Democrats, if you come at the king with something half-baked, you're going to feel bad about it. And the American empire, which, as J.D. Chuchilli has pointed out correctly, the most troubling thing about this is that it's all too easy to compare an American president to Julius Caesar. Let's think about that.
And, do they make as good a salad as Caesar?
That's a good point.
I think you've all raised wonderful points. I don't like Shakespeare. I find it boring.
I think our work here is done.
And yes. And Matt, I agree I with your philosophy of don't silenced. Be an asshole.
I guess that's a different play, right? The silence. Who? We have destroyed sleep, like Lady Macbeth or Macbeth. Andrew, what's your favorite Shakespeare play?
Well, not being a fan.
Have you ever seen, either of you, have you seen a production of a Shakespeare play that really resonated with you in a current moment? Because that's, you know, that's the idea behind, I mean, I guess there are different theories about, you know, dressing in contemporary garb, because that's what Shakespeare's productions tended to do when he was alive. But have you ever seen a Shakespeare play for the current moment that you actually thought illuminated anything?
Dude, I grew up in the Romeo plus Juliet. Claire
William
Danes
Shakespeare's. Yeah, Baz Luhrmann
edition, and I was like, I was into it. I was it was my so-called Shakespeare life, man.
Yeah, with John Leguizamo as I think Mercutio.
Yeah, it was good shit. For sure.
I saw, speaking of Richard III, I saw that played in Prague's National Theater with Sir Ian McKellen.
Woo!
Was that the fascist
yes.
version that was
so,
made into a movie? Yeah.
Yeah. So they went full Hitler in, you know, a city that was famously overrun by Hitler. And boy, did I hate it. I hated it with a white hot passion. Just like they were trying so hard to go obvious dictator. That's what has me worried, frankly, about the Rich III in the nearby park, is that like if you go too strong on the Trump Rich III thing, it's going to come off like cheap opportunism.
I saw a production, not Shakespeare, but I saw a production of the Don Giovanni, like of the opera, where they had recast everyone as like sex workers, and it worked so fucking well. It was kind of glorious, like Donna Elvira singing like "I love you, I hate you, I just want to hurt you," like all done up in dominatrix garb. The only downside of it was it was at a Liberty Fund conference. So it was like me and, you know, 15 like ancient classic scholars and a couple members of the board of Liberty Fund just watching like amazing. In the end, they all get hauled away by the vice squad instead of being dragged down to hell. It was pretty good.
Do you think that the next production was one of Carmen where it was set in an academic department?
Yeah, probably.
You know, that'd be kind of a nice flip. I am always amazed at the paltry selection. And I guess, you know, you're doing a Shakespeare in the Park or a Shakespeare Festival, it's going to be Shakespeare. But there's so many plays that are worth doing that talk about political power in really nuanced and interesting ways. And I'm thinking of something like Antigone, Sophocles' play, where the title character is wrestling with either following the laws of the city or a higher law. And it's, you know, there's so many things that could be done to kind of investigate power at any given moment. And it just seems to me that the, you know, Shakespeare, obviously, most of the tragedies and even a chunk of the comedies and obviously, I guess, all of the histories are about kings and courts. But they don't, I am mostly disappointed, like they don't seem to actually lend themselves that well to contemporary theorizing about stuff, I think.
I saw the Helen Mirren Antigone when they were doing that, like, you know, the thing where they simulcast filmed productions. And that was some good shit, man. And you were right. I got my libertarian on while I was watching that thing, because it's true. It's a much better, it captures in a very like distilled way this conflict of, you know, God's law and man's law or whatever.
Is there a taco bowl scene in that's where Brutus says, "Hey Julius, meet me down at Trump Tower, we're going to get the taco balls."
Well, guys, thank you. I'm smarter as always for having listened to you, Nick, Matt, and Catherine Menger Ward. You're listening to the Reason podcast. You can get it on iTunes, subscribe to us there, and rank and review it as well.